One of the most influential books I've ever read is Blindspot, The Implicit Biases of Good People. Co-authored by Mazarine Banerjee and Anthony Greenwald, this is an accessible presentation of what they learned from the implicit association test they conceived of, a test that reveals the biases carried by even the most progressive amongst us. In their book and presentation of the studies, Banerjee and Greenwald are clear that once we see these biases and acknowledge them, they can be dismantled. Today's episode is a guide for that, as I speak with returning guest Michelle Puckett about some of the ways that we, as white folk, can go about dismantling racial biases. Racial justice is at the forefront of the work Michelle does, work that she says always requires she come back to herself, all the time, in all ways. It is only through doing our own work that we can heal the wounds held and caused by our ancestors. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Kate.
Thank you so much for being on the show again.
I was excited to be.
So to begin, I'm asking guests this time around to share a bit about their experience growing up and the point at which they first began to be socially aware. So specifically in this case, could you talk a bit about when you became aware of difference and otherness?
Wow.
I know, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see here. Well, I grew up, I was born in Dallas, Texas in October of 1976, so about 41 years ago now. And I was raised in Dallas as well. When I became aware of difference, I mean, honestly, I think that it was always in my consciousness. I grew up in a working poor family, and you know, the neighborhoods that I grew up in were very mixed in terms of racial background, but not so much in terms of economic background, because I was growing up around other working poor people. So, So within that, you know, there were a whole lot of, as you can imagine, in Dallas, Texas, a lot of Mexican and Latino folks living in the neighborhoods that I grew up around, as well as other white working poor people, and more limited amounts of black folks and folks of other races. But racial difference is definitely one of the first things that I think I probably noticed in terms of difference because of the way that I grew up. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was your experience growing up, and like when did you start to do the kind of work that you're doing in the world where you really are like an ally and a support and a voice for change?
Yeah, I do, you know, racial justice work is central to pretty much everything that I'm interested in and I put my intention and energy behind in the world right now. That definitely was not the case when I was a little girl. I was more working in terms of just how to get along and play and be alive in the world that I was in, and how to interact with the people that made up my community. So I will say that, you know, I think anyone who knows me won't be surprised by this, because it's kind of a central thing that I've grappled with in my life. My father, who died of a drug overdose when I was a little girl, he was the not subtle version of racist. He was very overt, and he was also a working poor white guy who did have people of different races that he counted as friends, even though he had a very virulent sort of version of racism. I remember him using the kind of nasty words that we're not going to use on this program. And I mean, that really traumatized me, and obviously other people as well. So I remember from a really young age kind of knowing that that wasn't okay, and arguing with him about that in the ways that little kids can, you know, which is limited. And so that was definitely a very shaping thing for me to, and it was a real wounding thing when you think about, kind of what you introed with of how do we do this work as white folks. It was a really early wound. I think it's a big pattern for white people to, disown they're more overtly racist. Those of us who consider ourselves quote unquote conscious or woke, what have you, we have a knee jerk reaction to, you know, disown the people in our lives that we love who show that stuff. And I think that's a mistake. And I definitely fell into it. I couldn't figure out what else to do other than to, I mean, I still loved my dad, of course, but, you know, I definitely would hit his arm and be mad, show my anger at him when he would behave in these ways. But I was only 9 when he died. And so I created some narratives in my mind when he died, I think in part to cope with having lost him, of that he quote unquote wasn't a good person anyway, and that it was probably better this way because he was a racist, which I think, you know, now that I've gotten to do some of my healing work and as I've gotten older, I've realized how flawed and wrong that thinking is, and that he, of course, was a good person and all people are good people. And I've gotten to do more introspection and counseling work and various things that have helped me to see who he was and why he was the way that he was. And also to come to terms with the fact and to be able to really realize that there's not a real big difference between him and myself or anyone else, that all of us who grew up in this society internalize racism, whether that's as white people, we do take in the messages of the white supremacist society we live in, or as people of color who take in an internalized version of those messages, and same for women with men and all of that. So I'd say I've grown a lot and learned to have more compassion for who my dad must have been, and tried to remember that I'm part of him and that I get to help heal my ancestors and the wounds that they had and that they caused by doing my own work.
I mean, that's a really powerful message around healing, because I think that so much of the time as white people, when we're looking at racism, we think, oh, what can I do to help people of color?
Right.
Instead of what can I do to address my own implicit biases? And heal around whiteness, like
yes,
the healing work that needs to be done around mm-hmm. whiteness. So how has that been for you? Like, what's your, you can talk about the wound of that experience in your childhood, but what have been some of the steps that you've taken in ways that you've seen other aspects of the woundedness of whiteness?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I started with that example of kind of that division that I bought into and fed in my own life, my own family. And I'm not done with it. I'm not 100% done with it. It's an ongoing process.
I think that's a very valid point to really emphasize, is that this work is never done. I think that's another part of it, is like you were saying about people who think of ourselves like we're woke. Like,
right.
There's a sense of, like, I'm woke, I've arrived. Like, I don't have work to do anymore. Like, no, this is lifelong.
Right. Exactly. I was listening to Democracy Now! This morning, and I heard Amy Goodman asking, I believe it was a senator from New York who was born in Puerto Rico, about kind of Donald Trump's recent very overtly racist things that he's been saying. And she was kind of asking her, is he being racist? And even this woman, who is being a huge advocate for her people and, you know, really calling him out for some of the stuff he's doing, she was very reluctant to say the word racist, you know. And I think that that's a problem that we have in our society, of like, it's a hot potato, we're throwing it around. Nobody wants to be called a racist, but we know that we have some problems with racism in this world, and that means there are some racists, and it's okay to go ahead and name that. And I think that's part of what we got to do, is to be willing to take on that label and to say, yes, I am, I have racism in me, I'm going to keep on working on it, to kind of diffuse the bomb so that it can be worked on.
Yeah.
I think that's a big piece of what we have to do, because part of what it means is that we don't actually get to really fully know ourselves as white people, or as men, or as people who have owning class privilege, any of those sorts of categories of folks. You've got to fundamentally be denying parts of yourself and lying to yourself about things that you know are true because you can hear them and you can feel them inside yourself when you say the things or when you notice the things that you don't want to show. And that's a deep wounding. I think it's very traumatic to be separated from your own self in that way, mm-hmm. not be able to back yourself.
Yeah, and I think there's also that line that we draw between covert and overt racism. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we say, you know, like, oh, well, it's those racists. it's the racists that are very overt, which is, for me, I think, like, if you're overtly racist, then I know where you stand. mm-hmm. and it's, there's something kind of insidious then about the covert racism. And mm-hmm. it is hard. Like, it's only in the last few years that I've been able to go, yeah, I have racist thoughts. I have mm-hmm. racist beliefs. Mm-hmm. And to understand that that doesn't have to define who mm-hmm. I am, mm-hmm. But that it's there.
Right.
And it's worth working with, looking at, learning how to look at it.
Yeah, it demands that it be looked at and engaged with. And again, for me, it's been just really, really freeing to be able to begin having these kinds of conversations with people and just to be able to be honest about the fact that as much as we fight against what we don't believe in, as much as we fight against oppressive messaging, that we don't always win. And that's very humbling and it's useful. And I think it can breed compassion because, you know, all of us are in a position of privilege and in positions of being oppressed, depending on where we sit in society in different ways. And so we probably all have some of both of these pieces in us.
There's this really fantastic passage in the book Radical Dharma, just co-authored by three people, but I'm thinking of a passage specifically by Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. Mm-hmm. where she talks about the importance of white folks stepping up to their own front lines to do the work. And that mm-hmm. part of that is naming and examining what it means to be white. Mm-hmm. So what have been the things for you that you've done where you've like looked at what does it mean to be white? What does white privilege look like and how do you benefit from it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I think is a growing edge for me and something that I'm continually trying to figure out is how, as someone who grew up working class / poor white person, but who went on to college and, you know, I have a bachelor's and a master's degree. So it's necessarily changed who I am and the way that I can articulate and perceive the world. And some of that has been wonderful and some of the best experiences of my life. And some of it has been profoundly damaging and painful. And in some ways I can never go back. And so I do think a lot about how to have these types of conversations with people who come from where I come from, who didn't go where I went, you know, who didn't go to school and study all of the things that I have. I would say a lot of my awakening and kind of reckoning with my own privilege and all of that did come from going to college. And I definitely felt very marginalized in lots of ways because I was surrounded mostly by middle and owning class people. It also was really clear to me what a privilege it was to go to college and to begin having conversations through a more academic lens of like power and privilege and all of that and learning this step by step, you know, getting the chance to immerse yourself in learning these sorts of things. And I was involved in starting a student group at my undergraduate university, Naropa University, Buddhist inspired school in Colorado that was called Allies in Action. And we talked about diversity work back then, but it was about, you know, advocating for first year requirements for all incoming freshmen to take diversity courses because people were thinking that thinking about all of this stuff was just really optional and it was an extracurricular. And we said that's actually a really privileged position to take, that you think that you can opt out of it, and we're saying this is part of a baseline of what you need to know to move about in this world and to do so in an educated way, you know. So Yeah, that's where a lot of my initial experiences of getting to kind of grapple with and unpack and begin to look for the first time at my own biases and all of that was by taking a series of courses throughout my education that helped me, because there's a lot of good reading and writing out there that you can do. But beyond that, I would say some of the biggest ways that I've continued to do the work is through the work of reevaluation counseling, which is an anti-oppression model of how communities can help one another heal from the damages of oppression and the things that they do to our minds. And it's a very somatic practice, and it's based in really letting your body shake or laugh or sweat, cry, those sorts of things in response to the ways that you've been hurt. So once I got my initial understanding of power and privilege and difference, I have continued for the past 14 years, I've practiced reevaluation counseling and worked in small communities of people who are really actively trying to uncover their oppressor patterns and to work across difference to build communities that center the thinking and the voices of the most oppressed folks. So that has been probably the most transformative thing that I've done, is really get into my body and work with others and a common goal to undo this stuff.
So what have you learned about speaking to others and doing this work with others? Like, you know, how do you relate to your dad now and people like your dad now?
Well, you know, like I said, he's passed, so he sits on my ancestor altar, and I give him side eye and cuss him out when I feel like it, and I look at him and I give him my thanks for bringing me into the world, and I sit and let my heart open in compassion in front of his picture. So I feed him and I interact with him in those ways, and when I do work that I think is healing racism in the world, I do hold it up for him, for his upliftment as well. So that's how I relate to him now. But in terms of talking with people who are let's say, in different parts of this journey, because it's not like I'm all the way there, you know, for people who don't recognize some of the pieces that I have uncovered. The main thing that I see, you know, I mean, I'm no better than anyone else. And I think that this is a major white pattern is that separation piece that I opened with, of like, I'm different than you, and I'm going to show you that. I'm going to make a clear delineation. I'm going to put you on that side. I'm going to put me over here, and I'm going to feel really good about being right and rub your nose in it. And I think that that is really bad strategy for growing movements.
Yeah.
And it is detrimental to our own souls, and it tears communities apart. And I've participated in that lots in my life, and I regret that. And I continue to try and stop that pattern. But I think that one of the most important things to think about is connection. It's actually not like that we have to cultivate connection with people who think differently than us, or people who experience oppression differently than us, or anything. We are connected. That is a fact.
Yes.
And we don't have to develop it. We just have to decide to awaken to it. We have to decide to take it on. Yeah. And so I think acting from a place where you do your work through your meditation or your counseling practice, your somatic practices, whatever it is that you need to do so that you can figure out how to stay present when you feel triggered. Mm-hmm. And when you feel like you want to run away, or you feel like you want to shame someone else, but to remember that fact that, no, you are connected to this person. And how are you going to communicate with them and call forth their highest self? And obviously that's only going to happen if they feel connected to you, if they feel seen by you, if they if they think that you care, that you actually want to be in connection with them. You know, we do all this work, is so many good intentioned white allies will march out there and just really do this very transactional work where we don't actually want to have relationships with those people, you know, who look like the bad kind of white people. We don't want to be like, we just want to. And this is very colonial thinking, and this is very Christian hegemony thinking, but we want to convert them, you know, we want to convert them over to our way, but we don't actually want to sit down and have dinner with them because we don't really like them. We're not interested in them. And I don't think that works.
Yeah.
I think we have to remember that, that we are connected and that we have to do the humble work that is required for us to be able to, touch that connection.
What you're talking about is something that I wrestle with how to speak with other people about it, because you're talking about having compassion for the things we dislike in other people and having compassion for other people who embody things we dislike. So it's really hard for me to explain that to people because you have to do a lot of work around it. Like, you can't just tell someone compassion works. Like, you have to feel it and live it and have an actual experience of it for yourself to understand that, like, yes, actually, it is far better for my heart to wish that the Republican president would not suffer and would be happy. Because if he didn't suffer and he was happy, then a lot of other people wouldn't suffer as well. And I can do that work, and I've got to that place. So what are the ways that you have gotten to that place? Like, what's the work that you've done where you've been able to reckon with that and be able to see that?
Yeah. It's tricky because I know, in like loving kindness practices and things like that, sometimes you start with yourself because it seems easier or whatever. And then some people put yourself last because that's the hardest, you know? So it kind of depends on the way your patterns fall. But I think being able to love yourself and accept these pieces in yourself and look at the places where you got confused and where you have failed at fighting against accepting racism in your mind, because we always fight it. Nobody accepts to have oppressive thoughts in their minds. And
well, no one wants to think badly of themselves ever, really.
It's always something that gets forced down your throat, and at some point you lose the fight, and then you've got this mistaken thinking installed in your brain that you've got to do something with. And I think that the beginning is to be able to feel that compassion for yourself and to go back and remember what it was like for you to have that initial failure where you fought against, you know, maybe, you know, if you're a boy, you fought against talking bad about girls or what have you, until you got squashed so much that you went along with it for the first time, and to go back to that young person that you were and to really grieve and reclaim full connection to that young person. And then I think what we can do with ourselves informs what we can go out in the world and do with other people. And we can't really do much for or with other people that we can't figure out how to do for and with our own selves.
I think that's a really important part to remember, is that aspect of the learned quality of all of this, right? Like, you are not born fully formed with racist, sexist, misogynist, classist beliefs. Like, those are things you do absorb from the world around you, and very quickly. It's very like, especially gender, right? I mean, that's the first question we ask. What is it?
Yep. Anybody who gets to be around young people, very young people, babies, you know, there's no confusion whatsoever. You know that child has no racism in them. Mm-hmm. It really is something that we acquire. And, you know, I mean, I think that that's part of being a good ally or a good co-conspirator against racism too, is really trying to be a friend to young people and to help them think through this stuff, because it like so many things, these hardened belief systems, they congeal and become harder and calcified as we get older. And it's not like they're unworkable then, but certainly the very young are still actively seeing things differently. And we each get to play a role in whether or not we perpetuate this oppressive kind of paradigm being continued in how we interact with young people. I mean, a lot of people, I think, don't really recognize the fact that being a young person, being a child, is actually the very first oppression that we all face, and we all face it in common. Mm-hmm. There was a point at which we all depended on someone else for our actual ability to just survive. And, you know, that's a very vulnerable position to be in. And all of our parents and caretakers did the absolute best they could, of course, at any time, but we all got very hurt there. And so I think that that's another point at which we can touch into compassion with one another, is to remember that each one of us was a young person who came into the world just really expecting so much more freedom and looseness and connection than what we've been met with. And we all had to learn to adjust to the society as it is. And that was a very sad process for all of us.
Yeah, that's why I asked the initial question about otherness and difference, because I've looked at that in my past at different times. Like, when did I become aware of race? When did I become aware of gender? And it's so interesting, because exactly what you're saying, like, I became aware of gender, particularly when I started to get wounded for not being the right kind of girl. Gender didn't really exist for me until I started junior high, and suddenly I was being severely policed for not being the way I should be, not dressing the right way, not wearing makeup, like all that stuff. Mm. So yeah, it's and thinking about that, how early that starts around whiteness, how early that starts for little boys, like from the time they're four, like I have seen and witnessed that very sad lesson on toxic masculinity to small boys being told not to cry in public, and how hard that is. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about shame and guilt specifically.
Okay.
Because I think those are really heavy things to deal with, and that honestly, when we talk about the aggression that comes out around race, that is a mask for shame and guilt, in my experience. Mm-hmm. It's a mask for that fear, right? That not wanting to confront something uncomfortable in ourselves and sit with something uncomfortable. I've come to see that in my knee-jerk reaction to guilt and shame, I try to reason my way out of it, like basically to justify the things that I feel guilty and shamed of, rather than owning up to them. Mm-hmm. I'm learning how to do that. And that's been a huge process for me, That is an ongoing huge process for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what's your experience for working with guilt and shame for yourself, and also for the work that you do when you are out there in the community and working with other white folk?
Yeah. Again, it goes back to offering your own self loving compassion. And that's always easier said than done. Always, always. I mean, it is. And that's why I think somatic practice and meditative practices and traditional Eastern arts like Qigong and Tai Chi and things like that, these are things that we can use that can help us kind of get past the mind that wants to logic its way through an argument, and therefore only skates on the surface of things and really doesn't go deep. I think we have to get into our bodies and into where these things are stored in us as creatures, you know, as bloody creatures that carry these wounds in our bodies and get access that way. So there's a way that I think, when you talk about that feeling of shame or of guilt that comes up, how do you know it's there? It's because your body starts talking to you. You know, your face gets hot or your stomach starts to churn and be really uncomfortable. You know, it is clearly your body crying out, I'm hurt here. I know what's happening, you know? And so I think that is a major wound for us as white people, is being really disconnected from the earth and our bodies. And this is, you know, not something that I discovered on my own by any means. there's actually a somatic therapist out of Canada, a Japanese-Canadian person named Tada Hozomi, who is a somatic therapist who I think is just totally brilliant. And he is doing a lot of really incredible work around white people and helping us to become more aware of our oppressor patterns and how to work with them. And a lot of it is him encouraging folks to go into our bodies and to take on practices that allow us to connect in with our bodies and to notice what's happening, because your body's not going to steer you wrong, you know, in this work. You know, if you can feel what's happening, if you don't override, you know when you have a satisfied feeling of genuine connection with another person, or when you feel anxiety, or when you feel shame, you know, you can kind of tell when you're doing something wrong. But we're just so, you know, the colonial mindset just really has you override anything earthly, fleshy. So that's connection, connecting not only with one another, but with oneself and the earth. That's non-negotiable.
Yeah, I think that's also the reflection on the other things that we absorb from society. That's not even just the colonial heritage, but also the patriarchal attitude of pushing through toxic masculinity being very dominant in the culture of feelings are bad, and the materialist side of things, that you should be happy all the time and shiny and go buy stuff and
yes,
the messiness of being human.
Exactly. Yeah. There has to be a willingness to be vulnerable.
Yeah. And then that as well, right? Like, vulnerability is seen as something that is so, is weak, and yet actually it takes an incredible amount of strength to sit with this kind of discomfort.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like, compassion isn't easy, and that's an interesting one. I've heard that sort of from people where they're like, oh, well, I can be compassionate when things are going well and so on. And there's this sense like compassion is something you have if you're privileged. Like, last time I checked, the most privileged in the people in the world weren't really showing a lot of compassion.
right. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you've been talking about oppressor patterns. You mentioned that a few times. Could you just talk a little bit about that? Because that's not a phrase I've heard before.
Well, it's a phrase that comes out of, in my experience, it comes from my experience with reevaluation counseling. And it's just to name the fact that the isms that we have in us are not native to us, as we've already established. You know, they're learned behaviors, and they're patterns that they have to be installed in us. They're not something that we come into the world with. And society's got a mighty job to do, actually, to get it into us, because we are such loving, connected, brilliant little creatures when we first get here, you know. And it's not easy to convince these fleshy little babies that being connected and loving with another person isn't a good thing. So we go through a very brutal regimen of having oppressor patterns installed on us, and that's everything from the telling the little boy not to cry, like you already mentioned, to some of the things that I saw growing up, you know, the things my dad was trying to teach me, talking the way that he did. You know, he didn't know he was trying to teach them to me. He had those same experiences happen to him, and he accepted them. And I was so young when he died that I was still very much in the process of fighting back, you know, and he died before I fully gave in to all of those messages. So I think oppressor patterns being able to name them, you know, is really useful, and being able to hold on to, you know, there's not much that we can do if we actually do think that there are some bad people. Like, what's the point? What's the point of doing social justice or change work? Like, that's really the thinking that lies behind, well, lock them up or kill them, you know, whatever, like, draw the line and let's just keep the good ones. Like,
it's true. If you know, are inherently evil and bad, then we wouldn't be surprised and we wouldn't be expecting more from them.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's I think that it's really useful to be able to have a term like oppressor pattern to differentiate that the goodness of that human from these really ugly things that they've taken on, that they need to unlearn, that are not workable and are unacceptable and are harming people, but they don't speak to who the essence of that person is.
Could you speak to knowing when not to have the conversation? Because I think that's a big problem, and especially online.
Well, I feel like I'm just saying the same thing over and over again, but I've got to tell you, you've got to check in with yourself and your body.
You know, though, it's important, because by this time in the episode, there will be someone who hadn't quite heard it, and now they'll hear it. If I learned anything from listening to Buddhist teachers, they basically say the exact same thing all the time.
Right, repetition is our friend, yes.
Meditate.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you have to check in with yourself, with your body, with your capacities. I mean, everything is contextual. And if you have somebody that you love who's like dying of cancer and you're helping care for them, and if you've got all kinds of things going on that have taxed you beyond what is going to be a workable frame of mind for you to enter into a good conversation with compassion and an intention to be connected to a person, you can pretty much bet you're going to get into one of those ugly Facebook spirals that's just really forgetting the other person as a person and all of that. And we don't need more of that in the world. So maybe it's best not to start typing in that moment. Yeah, there are a lot of different things that you can do, though, you know, I mean, and especially if it's somebody you know, maybe pick up the phone and have a conversation instead. Get to a place of genuine love. That's easier to do when you hear somebody's voice of somebody that you love rather than just like that anonymous kind of font on on Facebook or whatever, and then come back and make whatever your little public statement is. I think Facebook and social media and digitally are, you know, like it's important, and we've done a lot of consciousness raising, and I certainly share things all the time that I believe in on Facebook and all of that, but that's not the place where you're going to actually have transformative conversations with people that change hearts and minds. Like, it's got to come off of the screen.
I know you've given a lot of really good advice for listeners, very specific advice repeatedly, but is there anything else you'd like to offer for anyone who's doing this kind of work, some sort of support or guidance?
I would say, you know, self-care gets talked about more and more these days, and it needs to keep on being talked about more and more because we're really bad at it, especially people who believe in more justice in the world. So I have a real problem. I'll say, you know, I think people who were raised poor or working class, we have a particular struggle around thinking of self-care as something that is only available with a certain amount of luxury or, you know, class privilege or what have you. And so we don't even want to engage in it because it feels so uncomfortable. It feels like you're being a traitor or something like that. And I struggle mightily with it to this day. I did today. I struggle with it every day. With, you know, allowing myself to, I mean, I'm a poet, you know, to read some poetry or to have a nice bath or to spend time on myself, helping build myself up and be loving towards myself, because there's this terrified, frozen feeling of like so many people are suffering and how can I do this for myself? And what I'm really working on is getting out of this zero-sum game worldview that is very capitalistic and, you know, has been imposed on my mind. And to remember that, you know, when I talk about wanting more peace and justice and joy in the world, I want people to have that. I'm included in that equation. You know, like, I want something, if I want to, you know, be able to actually make sure that I'm making a difference that's measurable, that I can tell, I'm a pretty great place to start. I have a lot of control over my own life, and to behave kindly towards myself and treat myself with good nutrition and exercise and all of those sorts of things, is a gift to the movement, and it does increase the justice and the joy and the freedom in the world. And that's a hard thing for me to remember, but I do think it's true. And I think people who engage in this work regularly deserve it.
Michelle Puckett is a co-founder and faculty member of the Creating Freedom Movement. This is a popular education movement that's committed to fostering and supporting leaders working towards a beloved community. To find out more, visit creatingfreedommovements.org. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit caitlinschatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of More Music for the original theme song.